Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. And today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with an interview about the Environmental Protection Agency's order for much stricter PFOS and PFOA water standards. Then we have a plastic story on greenwashing and artificial turf. Later on, we hear some speakers from a rally in reaction to the overturn of Roe v. Wade. After that, we speak with Salem Arts Works Executive Director about the exhibition coming up that showcases works from current artists in residence. Finally, we get our weekly dose of weather with meteorologist Hugh Johnson. We'll talk about summer clouds, but first, here are the headlines. The Times Union reports that two brothers allege that Gary Mercure, a former priest convicted of raping boys in Massachusetts, had sexually abused them along with former Albany Bishop Howard Hubbard. The two testified a decade ago at the trial that sent Mercure to prison for 20 years for raping them. The Capital Region is set to receive $27.2 million dollars in transportation funding to promote environmentally friendly modes of travel and making it easier to walk or bike. The Times Union stated that the funding is part of $178.8 million awarded to 75 communities statewide. More than two-thirds of the projects will benefit environmental justice communities consisting of predominantly communities of color and low and moderate income families. Protests continue locally and nationwide over the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade and the right to abortion. This followed on other court controversies over guns and environmental regulations. Many world leaders reacted with shock and dismay to the U.S. decision to allow states to deny a right to abortion and significantly curtail women's rights. The first of two statewide primaries concludes on Tuesday, June 28th. For most Capital District Democrats and Republicans, they only have the primaries for governor and lieutenant governor, which are determined separately, unlike in the general, where they run as a combined ticket. The primary for Congress and state Senate is August 23rd, with early voting before that. Schenectady County Ministries on Tuesday will launch its annual Summer Meals program, which provides thousands of free meals to Schenectady County youth with a kickoff event at Vale Farm. The Gazette reports that SICM has been operating the summer meal programs for the past 28 years, serving 57,632 meals last year, including breakfast and lunch. The Daily Gazette reports that health insurers are asking state regulators for their largest premium increases in several years, a weighted average of 18.7% for the individual market and 16.5% for the small group market. The requests submitted by Capital Region-based insurers MVP, Healthcare, and CDPHP range from 13.6% to 38.4%, with average rate increases of as much as 48.2%. The State Department of Financial Security Services usually agrees to a somewhat lesser amount than originally requested. The Rensselaer County Legislature has confirmed the appointment of Michael Mahone as Commissioner of the County Department of Social Services and Joseph Mazzariello as Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Training. The Board of Directors of Capital Roots has scheduled a meeting on Thursday, June 30th, to decide on a response to a letter signed by 80% of staff members that they want a union and want the group to voluntarily recognize it. The workers had requested an answer by the end of the week. The New York State judge struck down a new law on Monday that gave hundreds of thousands of non-citizen legal residents of New York City the right to vote in municipal elections, but not state or federal. New York Governor Kathy Hochul is bringing state lawmakers back on Thursday, June 30th, for a special session to consider gun safety legislation in response to the Supreme Court striking down key provisions of the state's licensing law. She does not plan to do anything with the equality amendment or abortion on Thursday, but said she is willing to call lawmakers back again when they have a consensus. And that's it for the headlines. For our first story, Bob Hayes, the clean water director at Environmental Advocates, discusses with Mark Dunley the impact of the changes to the advisory levels for PFOA and PFOS forever chemicals set by the Environmental Protection Agency.
We're joined by Rob Hayes, who's the director of clean water for Environmental Advocates in New York. Back on June 15th, I believe, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency issued some new advisories for water standards, particularly for the chemicals, forever chemicals known as PFOA and PFAS, P-O-F-O-A, both of which have been involved in local controversies such as Hoosier Falls and the Norlite hazardous waste incinerator, plus many other, you know, communities. So, Bob, what was the EPA announcement all about?
You know, a couple of weeks ago, EPA came out with new health advisory levels for several PFAS chemicals, including PFOA and PFOS, which are the most common. They've gotten the most attention here in New York. And really what EPA said is, you know, confirmed what advocates have been saying for a long time, which is that there is no safe level of PFOA or PFOS in drinking water. Wherever these chemicals are detected, there is a risk to human health, and they need to be removed from drinking water as soon as possible.
Now, has there been any particular reaction yet from state officials as to, you know, whether this is going to spur them to take some increased action?
You know, all we've heard from state officials so far is that they're reviewing this new science. But what we really need is action. You know, we need Governor Hochul and her administration to follow this new science and say, we are going to get these toxic forever chemicals out of our drinking water. Right now, the governor's administration is deciding what drinking water standards they're going to set for almost two dozen more PFAS chemicals in drinking water. We need the governor's administration to set those standards at the lowest possible levels so that whenever these chemicals are detected, the public is notified and treatment technology is installed so that everyone has clean water when they turn on the tap.
Now, I happen to reside in Postenkill, New York, and, you know, well, last year sometime looking at the town's website, I said, what? They discovered PFOA contamination at the local middle school. And, you know, the state has come out and slowly have tested a number of wells, you know, a bunch of wells above what the standard of 10 parts, others a little bit lower than that. But, you know, so far, you know, the state health department, DEC, county health department, not really all that high. EPA is sort of saying, yes, it is. And if they're at 4 or 3 or 15 or 25, you should be doing something.
Oh, absolutely. Right now, New York allows 10 parts per trillion of PFOA or PFOS in drinking water. That's 10 times higher than EPA is now saying is safe to drink. So absolutely, there are many private wells in Postenkill and other places across the state that have below 10 parts per trillion of these chemicals in their drinking water, but EPA is now telling us are facing a risk to their health. So absolutely, the state needs to lower that 10 part per trillion standard, set it as close to 2 parts per trillion as possible, which is the lowest level we can currently reliably detect, so that whenever these chemicals are found, they're removed from the drinking water and public health is fully protected.
Now, one, I guess, perhaps devil advocate's question I'll raise is, seems like these chemicals are popping up all over the place. As more people test, more they find it. And, you know, it's not free to clean up. In fact, it's not even free to get your water tested. How does the state have enough money to, you know, really clean all this up? Or they need to be, you know, charging some additional levies on the manufacturers? What's the financial situation with all this?
You know, fortunately, there are a number of ways that water utilities can recoup the costs from cleaning up their water so that those costs aren't passed on to ratepayers. First is that where a polluter is identifiable, that polluter can be held accountable. And that's the ideal scenario. The chemical companies and other polluters that put these chemicals in our water, that poisoned our water, they should be the ones that pay to clean it up. In those instances where we can't find a polluter, fortunately, a lot of state and federal funds have been invested over the last few years to help improve water infrastructure and to install new treatment technology. New York State has put over $4 billion into a program called the Clean Water Infrastructure Act in recent years. And New York is about to receive a lot more money from the federal government from the recently passed bipartisan infrastructure law. So fortunately, we now have the resources to set the strongest and lowest possible standards while also preventing those costs from falling on customers that are already having trouble paying their bills. It's really a win-win for both, people's finances and public health.
Now, if listeners out there are concerned about this, I guess sort of a two-part question. One, what are some of the health risks, associated with these two particular chemicals? And, what should a homeowner or resident, do at this point if they're concerned about this issue?
There are a long list of health effects associated with PFAS exposure, from kidney cancer to testicular cancer to thyroid disease to preeclampsia and low birth weight. The CDC website has a great list of all the health effects if your listeners want to go on there and find out more. In terms of what you can do if these chemicals are found in your water, first, that if you're served by a public water system, you can demand that your public water system and that your governor clean up your drinking water, that they are required to install filtration technology. If you're on a private well, things are tougher, but you can still demand that the state and Governor Hochul pay for you to have treatment technology installed and regular testing done, because it shouldn't matter whether you're on a public system or a private well. Every single New Yorker deserves clean drinking water.
And this may be changing the subject a little bit, but, you describe, some various funding sources to deal with the issue and clean up of the water. I believe that there's an Environmental Bond Act on the ballot this November. Does the Bond Act cover things of this nature?
That's a really great point. There is some funding in the Environmental Bond Act specifically to help upgrade water infrastructure, and that could be used for PFAS testing and treatment. So absolutely, a lot of money in the Bond Act, over $100 million, I think, to help address this problem. And so that will go before voters this November. And we hope that as many New Yorkers as possible get out to the polls and vote yes for clean water and the jobs that will come with that.
Now, we've had you on several times talking about the efforts of IU and other environmental groups to get the Council on Drinking Water Quality to take some more actions around notifications. You want to give us a quick update on that and how would this impact upon what that's going on?
Sure. So New York has a state drinking water quality council that is meant to advise, the governor's office and the State Department of Health about what new protections we need to keep our drinking water clean and safe to drink. As of right now, there is not another meeting of the council scheduled. We really hope that they'll be taking EPA's new science into consideration and lowering their recommendations for what standards to set on these toxic PFAS chemicals. But ultimately, the ball is still in the governor's court and the Department of Health's court. They are the final decision makers about what amount of these toxic chemicals are we going to allow in our water. And that's why it's so important for them to really strengthen the current proposed standards and make sure that we're getting these chemicals completely out of our water.
Now, for my last question, which is probably a separate show but in and of itself, the United States Supreme Court is expected to rule momentarily on the issue of what is the power of EPA to regulate carbon emissions, but it really goes to the broader issue, what is the ability of these various executive agencies to issue regulations under the laws that Congress has passed. Would these type of drinking water quality issues be impacted possibly by this pending United States Supreme Court decision in the last 45 seconds?
You know, I don't believe so. Fortunately, the Safe Drinking Water Act is very clear that states have the authority to set new drinking water standards, including standards stricter than what the EPA has set. So I don't imagine that these drinking water standards might be impacted, but I do know that the Supreme Court ruling could have devastating impacts on federal climate action. And it's, you know, it's another reason why it will be so important for New York to continue to play a leadership role on these environmental issues.
We've been talking with Rob Hayes, Director of Clean Water of Environmental Advocates of New York, leave EANY.org. This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
PFOA and PFOS forever chemicals have been at the center of the water controversy in Hoosick Falls and the Norlite Hazardous Waste Incinerator in Cohoes. We have been following the local stories of the impacts of these chemicals. You can find those on our website, mediasanctuary.org. Greenwashing is a term that refers to when polluting practices are advertised as environmentally sustainable, and this is what the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility have filed a complaint about relating to the manufacturers of artificial turf.
My name is Kyla Bennett, and I work for PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. I am PEER's Science Policy Advisor.
Welcome to the show, Kyla. Recently, PEER submitted a complaint to the Federal Trade Commission regarding artificial turf. Can you please explain what artificial turf is and what the nature of PEER's complaint is?
Sure. So artificial turf is basically a plastic field. There are usually three layers to artificial turf, sometimes four, but basically it's a woven plastic backing with fake green grass blades, and then some kind of infill system, which used to be crumb rubber, which is just ground up tires, but lately, industry has been moving away from the crumb rubber because of the dangers associated with it, and they're putting in all sorts of what they call organic infills, such as coconut husks or walnut shells or sand or ground up Nike sneakers, things like that. But basically, the system, this three-layered system, and sometimes there's a shock pad underneath that, replaces grass for football fields and other sport fields.
And what was the complaint that PEER submitted to the Federal Trade Commission?
So all of these artificial turf vendors and manufacturers are marketing these artificial turf systems as environmentally sound and a green alternative. And part of that whole greenwashing is they say that these fields are recyclable, and they're really not. So our complaint to the Federal Trade Commission is claiming that this is deceptive or unfair marketing, and they are making false and misleading statements that people are relying on. People are thinking, oh, we're doing the right thing environmentally by using this artificial turf, and at the end of its life, which is usually about 8 years or so, we can recycle it so it's all good and we can feel good about ourselves. But it's just simply not true because there are currently no recycling facilities in the United States.
So for those listening who maybe don't know what greenwashing is, it's just a term that refers to a practice that is advertised as environmentally sustainable, but in fact, it is not. So can you talk about why this is greenwashing? Why is artificial turf such a problem, or replacing natural grass with plastic grass a problem?
There are so many problems. I could sit on this show for 3 hours and tell you all the problems with artificial turf. But the short version is this. When you have a natural grass field, even if you're using, you know, fertilizers and you have to water it, things can grow in it, and there's soil and there's plants, and things get washed into the soil and absorbed. With these plastic grass fields, Water can percolate through it, but unfortunately they're made with so many dangerous chemicals that those chemicals are leaching off the field. And what we're finding now is that they're getting into the soil and the drinking water. And for decades, people were focused solely on the dangers of the crumb rubber infill, because tires, as you know, they're toxic. You know, you can't, for a number of reasons, you can't put them in landfills even. So here they are grinding them up and letting kids play on them, which is kind of nonsensical to me. But what we discovered in 2019 is that these artificial grass fields are made with PFAS, per and fluoroalkyl substances. And these are nicknamed forever chemicals. They're incredibly dangerous. There are three pathways of exposure. You can get them into your body through dermal absorption, you can get them through ingestion, and you can get it through inhalation. And just 2 weeks ago, EPA came out with a risk assessment saying that basically there are no safe levels of at least two of these thousands of this big class of chemicals. And we are finding those two chemicals in this artificial turf. So what you've got is you've got, you know, these chemicals that are incredibly dangerous, they're carcinogens. They're being used to manufacture these grass fields, and they leach off and get into the soil and into the water that we're drinking. So it's not only is it bad from that perspective, these grass fields get incredibly hot, anywhere from 35 to 55 degrees Fahrenheit higher than natural grass. And the injury rate is much higher as well. So there's really nothing redeeming about these fields. And one of the only selling points remaining is that they are good for the environment, but they're not. So it is a very misleading claim that these companies are giving people.
Can you give us an idea of just how many artificial turf fields exist in the United States, and how these communities are convinced by the manufacturers to replace their grass turf with plastic turf?
Those are two really good questions. And there are, we don't know exactly how many. There are probably around 15,000 now, and they're getting more put in every day. And in fact, because of climate change, there are a lot of municipalities and states out west that are saying, you can't ban these things because we're saving water by putting them in. So that's one of the arguments that we're hearing from the manufacturers and the landscape architects who are pushing these things, is that you don't have to water them, which is actually not true. You do have to water them to keep the heat down, because they can get to be 180 degrees, 200 degrees. And we've had athletes die. We've had kids collapse from heat stroke. So it's really quite dangerous. So they're using the arguments, what I've heard so many. I've heard it's good for the environment because you don't have to use pesticides. Well, you do still sometimes have to use pesticides, because you have plants growing up through the artificial turf, and you can have organic grass. You don't have to use pesticides on a regular grass field. We're told your kids can't be competitive. You know, you're not going to be the next Tom Brady if you don't play on artificial turf when you're in high school or in middle school. That's not true. The NFL is trying to move away from artificial turf because of the injury rate. Players actually do not like playing on artificial turf because they get injured so much more. Different kinds of injuries, but they get injured, non-contact injuries, on these artificial turf fields. The biggest argument we hear is that, especially in places like New England where I am, because of rain and snow and all the weather that we get, that you get more playing hours out of artificial turf. And that can be true if you have a poorly managed natural grass field. But we've come such a long way in being able to manage grass fields and make them last if you use the right kind of grass and you have the right kind of drainage system. So that argument also fails ultimately. And even if you did get more playing hours out of a plastic field than a natural grass playing field, all of the bad things associated with plastic grass, the heat islands, the injury rate, the poisonous chemicals coming off of it, they definitely outweigh those extra playing hours. So it's really unfortunate that people, that municipalities are falling for this greenwashing that's being done by the manufacturers and the landscape architects.
And how do you hope that the Federal Trade Commission will respond to Pierre's complaint about these deceptive greenwashing arguments?
I imagine they will do nothing, which is what they usually do when we send them complaints. But I'm hoping that other states will see this. So for example, we did an FTC complaint, I think back in 2015, about mosquito misters. And FTC did nothing, but they filed it. So other states that were searching found it. And the state of Connecticut actually banned mosquito misters after we filed our complaint. So I'm hoping that it will at least open up the conversation. I don't think the FTC will do anything because they don't tend to take strong actions, but you know, in the best of all possible worlds, they would at least stop them from making these false claims about the recyclability. But at least this is opening up a conversation between municipalities and parents and players and coaches so that we can look at the facts rather than the myth of how much better these artificial turf fields are and try to make informed decisions.
And this has been Kyla Bennett with the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. In the last 30 seconds, where can people go to learn more about PEER and artificial turf?
You can go to our website, which is www.peer.org. And we're actually giving a free webinar on artificial turf in New York tomorrow at noon. And that is also on our website. You can register. As I said, it's free. And we're going to have a doctor from Mount Sinai Hospital talking about how bad they are. We're going to have an environmental group on Long Island talking about how dangerous they are. And I'm going to be talking as well.
So for clarification, that webinar is going to be on Tuesday, June 28th at noon, and we'll post the link for the webinar with on mediasanctuary.org with this podcast post. So thank you, Kyla.
Thank you.
Alexis Goldsmith is our plastics correspondent who looks as deep into the issues around plastics and recycling. And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. The overturn of Roe versus Wade has brought people to the streets to express their frustrations, fears, sorrows of what is happening. Bria Barthel attended a rally in opposition to the overturn and brings us these excerpts.
Thank you all so much for being here and being in community today. I think Shelley said it the best. We can be sad in this moment. I think we all have a lot of righteous anger and rage as well, and we have to get to work, and we deserve a different future. We experienced a day today where my girls grew up with less rights than we had this morning, and that is unacceptable. And so thank you all. Thank you all for showing up today. We need you to show up tomorrow, and we need to fight together. This is the good fight. It's the right fight, and we're the right people to take it. So here we go.
This is Kathy Dawson. Everybody give Kathy a round of applause.
Hi, thank you all. I'm a registered nurse at Ellis Hospital. I'm on the board of directors for NYSNA. NYSNA is behind this 100%. And something that hasn't really been talked about, and I might piss off my doctor friends, but I don't care. Abortion in the United States was legal up until probably the mid-1800s. it became illegal and immoral when the fledgling AMA realized they were losing money to midwives who provided abortion care. Oh, sorry.
Okay. You're saying good stuff.
Yeah. It's the money. Really, it's the money. The AMA was losing money to midwives who provided abortion care in America up until probably the mid-1800s. It was legal. It was safe. Midwives took care of women like they're supposed to. And then all of a sudden, the AMA realized they were losing money to the midwives. So here we are, full circle. Now it's back to being illegal again. And people are thinking it's immoral, and it's just not. It's about healthcare and human rights.
Thank you for that history lesson. Awesome. I didn't know that. Hi, everyone. My name is Nathaniel Gray. I'm the executive director of the Pride Center right up on Hudson. Thank you. Thank you. You may have come to our Pride Festival a couple of weekends ago if you were able to join us there. Thank you for joining us. It was awesome. This day, I want to start off by saying I am not someone who is impacted by this ruling today. I was not born with a uterus in my body. And that means my right wasn't taken away. But I was born by someone who had one. Every one of you here was born by someone who had one. Every one of you here knows someone who had a right destroyed today. I heard some amazing statements at the press conference earlier, thinking about, could you imagine being an 18-year-old girl in New York State right now, or a person who can get pregnant? You get a free ride to the college of your choice. You're getting your dream education. Everything's gonna happen in the fall. That college is Tulane University. It's in a state that has a trigger ban that will tell you you cannot have an abortion tomorrow. It's in Missouri, a state with a trigger ban where you cannot get an abortion now, tomorrow. What do you do? It does impact us here. This blue marble of a state is not actually safe for young women anymore. You work for a job that has locations across the country and you get an opportunity that you want to take, and it's in a state where if someone chooses to rape you, you're forced to have a child? That's unsafe. We are not safe anymore. And the reason I'm so mad right now is because of the fact that I know better than to stand in front of the speakers, sorry. But also because of the fact that I look at this sea of amazing people who have come here tonight, and I thank you all for being here, for Planned Parenthood, for these groups that have organized this, and thank you for organizing it. And I also, while I see a decent number of men's faces, I see way more women's faces. And the problem with that is, the women are the people impacted today. Where are you men at? If you cry today because your daughter lost her rights, you shouldn't also have to be up here screaming. You should be mourning and dealing and processing and thinking and hoping and planning and consoling. And the reason I say that is I end all of my trainings this way, and I will end this little statement this way on what we need in our country right now. Abolition of slavery did not happen because black people did not want to be enslaved. If we were a moral country, we would never have had slavery in the first place. That's the moral argument. All right? It happened because enough time passed that enough white people who would lose absolutely nothing literally started a war. Are you ready?
Yeah.
I'm not saying we start a war, but I'm saying we fight in every possible way that we can. And the way we fight is not to ask the people who just had their rights taken away to fight it by themselves. I need to see more men's faces in every single one of these things, every single time it happens. That's the only way the law will change. That's it, all right? I will shamelessly plug that if you're not LGBTQ, I need you to fight for me too, all right? We are fighting together now. This is together now. We have to be together now because they're together, they're organized. They've been organized for 49 years to get rid of this. We cannot wait that long. We have to fight harder and faster and better than them at this fight right now. So I need to see black, brown faces, white faces, women's faces, men's faces, people who are gender non-conforming and non-binary faces. I need to see every single person out here, and I will be out here as an angry man with no uterus whose rights were not taken away because of the fact that I love a lot of people who were. So please, 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 please. If you look around yourself and you don't see the men in your life and they should be here, tell them that, right? Hold the line. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. This is probably the most important day of my life so far. And we have to make sure that this does not stay the law of the land. It will not stay the law of the land. And we will fight together, men, women, everyone else, black, white, people of color, all genders, races, religions, abilities. We have to. They're coming for us. Thank you.
And that means that some of our contraceptives will no longer be allowed in some states. Yep. Contraceptives are the sole reason why women can be able to work more. If you force birth in one of these states, alrighty, thank you. If you force birth in one of these states where you don't even, you know, want to make universal health care, then you're going to be taking these women out of work. These women will no longer be able to provide for their own life, let alone a child. And then you are increasing the wage gap. You're putting women back. This is not just about abortions, it's also about our right to contraceptions. This affects hormonal birth control, any type, the pill, the hormonal IUD, the hormonal arm insert, because while hormonal birth control first works to prevent your ovaries from releasing an egg, it also prevents implantation. So you'll lose hormonal birth control, you'll lose copper IUDs, you'll lose Plan B. We're all unsafe. It's not just people who need abortions, but they're important too, just as much as anybody else. And I've always been very lucky because I've lived in Vermont and New York, so I felt very safe. And honestly, the way that I grew up born in 2000, and I have become a very liberal woman, and I watched the Supreme Court guarantee that anybody could marry anybody when I was in high school. And I was happy. And it felt like the world had constantly been moving forward to treating everybody else like a human, like we care about them. Today, it feels like it's going backwards, and it hurts my heart. And I hope that we can all work together to make sure that it will never go backwards again.
That coverage from a rally in support of abortion access came from Bria Barthel. In the north of the 518 is Salem Artworks, a space to support emerging and established artists through residencies, workshops, and access to specialized facilities. I reached out to learn more.
I'm Pearl Kafritz, currently the executive director at Salem Artworks.
So Salem Artworks is based in Salem, New York. This great art space. Could you tell us a little bit about what is Salem Artworks?
Certainly. So Salem Artworks was founded by Anthony Kafritz 17 years ago. It's a 119-acre sculpture park, but we also offer events, workshops, youth programming, and residencies.
What are some of the specialized art facilities that Salem Artworks has to offer?
Okay, so our workshop spaces are comprised of different studios, and you can learn to your skills within those studios. So, for instance, we have a glass blowing shop, blacksmith shop, ceramics, and our ceramicist specializes in wood fire kilns. We also do stone carving, welding, and metal casting, as well as metal pours.
And these are facilities that artists generally don't have private facilities in their space. It's more difficult maybe to work on these crafts if you don't have access to a space, which might fold into my next question. So art residencies are a big part of what Salem Artworks does. What is the experience of the artist residency, and why are these really important opportunities for the development of artists?
Okay, so Salem Artworks, our backbone is residencies. We're built to be a residency program. That is definitely what the intention was when SPA first began, and it's still the same intention. There's three easily comparable groups of residencies. Now that we're back in season, we're running a full season, which we haven't been able to do since 2019. We ran half of the season last year, but we're doing back to a full season this year. We got to bring back the work trade. So it's the young and the studio. They're here from anywhere for 6 to 8 weeks. There's about four in each group. Young just purely means young in your career. So you're at the beginning stages of your art making or art process. So they do an exchange for 30 hours a week and help us with the grounds or any projects we have. And in exchange, they get studio access, meals, as well as housing. And then a step above that is the studio artist program. And they're further along in their career and have a good working knowledge of several disciplines, but they'll focus in one. So for instance, the gentleman who's in charge of our glass program has a studio assistant. The same with the blacksmith, as same as the welding, as same as the ceramics. So the studio artist is once again a work exchange, but they'll focus in helping with the workshops, helping teach, helping with tech support within those individual studios, and maybe also help produce merchandise. So they're the studio artists, and they're a work exchange. Above and beyond that, we have fully subsidized artists that come through that we, right now we have the New York Vermont program. It's a juried selection as well as the Young and Studio. These are all application juried selections. And the New York Vermont artists are here. There's 11 of them. They're here for 2 weeks. There is no work exchange. They're here to create art, spend time in their studio, and they're going to be culminating in a group show this Friday, July 1st. Right here in downtown Salem at North Main Street. So besides the New York Vermont program, we also have Salem to Salem, which is a fantastic program, and it's an exchange between us, Salem, New York, and Salem, Germany. And each side nominates 10 artists. The 20 artists get together. Once again, there's no work exchange. Their focus is to be in the studios, work independently, to collaborate, and they also have a culmination of a show at their end of their residency program. And then we, besides the Young and Studio Work Exchange, the fully subsidized, which are currently in the New York, Vermont, and Salem to Salem, we also offer independent artists to come. There's flat fees that we have on our website where they can pay for housing, pay for studio, and then also pay for studio equipment or what they need in the individual spaces. So those are kind of the three different levels.
You mentioned that the New York and Vermont Artist Residency has their studio exhibition this Friday, July 1st. Who will be showing there? What can some of the visitors expect to see?
So once again, it's kind of just a really great selection of what SAW has to offer. So it's all different mediums, all different artists. We have people working in glass, people working in soapstone, ceramics, two-dimensional, blacksmithing. So it's just a really beautiful culmination of work that they're going to be able to show on that July 1st.
And you were talking about these work exchanges and possibilities for subsidized residency fees. Artist spaces have historically been exclusive and not welcoming to all people. So how, beyond just the financial side of things, how does Salem Artworks make the arts more accessible?
I think that's exactly what the core mission and the vision is for SAW, and that was the intent of the founder, is just to allow for it to be accessible. and that's through the work programs or through New York, Vermont, and Salem, the Salem. And then our costs are extremely nominal for the independent artist to be able to come and stay and work and eat and then collaborate with other artists. It's very welcoming location. It's a very welcoming area. The Sculpture Park alone and its beautiful vistas and views. It's a really beautiful place to be able to have a peace of mind and just gather some oxygen and move forward as an artist.
What is your feeling on why this separation has happened and why some demographics don't feel comfortable applying to certain art programs or feel like it's accessible to them?
I honestly don't know the answer to that, and it's something that we, of course, been thinking about throughout the years. The New York Vermont program is the second year. Year one was literally called the 518 because it was last year, and it was the year that we couldn't cross state lines yet. And the program is, its emphasis is allowing people to might remove financial constraints and be able to have this breath to make art. One of the application questions and requirement is as a total household, you can't earn more than $50,000. So it's for underrepresented artists to be able to take the time, have the breath, have everything included in their program, as well as a $500 unrestricted stipend and the freedom to also, if they need time to work, they can, of course, but like the main focus while they're here is just to really be in your studio. So we've really advertised and all the different areas, and we have lots of one-on-one networking and phone conversations and just really trying to connect with artists that need to be able to have a break and want the opportunity to come up and spend time. And not only, sometimes even artists will come up as a painter and leave as a sculptor. It's also learn different disciplines, and everybody's extremely welcoming and trying, and collaboration is the baseline of SAW.
So for listeners who may not have had the exposure to blacksmithing, glasswork, woodworking, what are some really interesting aspects to this work that might help people to engage with these mediums?
I think that it's an interesting aspect, but also the way the programs are set up, it's really wonderful because you can be anywhere from beginner to master. So there's availability for anybody to just try, to try blacksmithing or to try glass blowing. And I mean, myself and my children, we've signed up for workshops before, and it's just a learning curve, and the instructors are really great at giving very clear information and guiding you and helping you with whatever you need to be able to feel like you're succeeding through the workshop.
Thank you, Pearl Kofferitz, for joining us. How can listeners find more information about Salem Artworks?
Oh, wonderful question. So the easiest way is just to head towards our website, which is just salemartworks.org. On there, well, you can find our calendar of all of our upcoming events, as well as our upcoming workshops that we have, including our summer teen art program and events, workshops, and residencies.
Well, thank you for taking the time as you're preparing for this Friday's exhibition. Thank you for coming to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been my pleasure.
And that New York, Vermont artist reception is on Friday, July 1st. All that information is at salemartworks.org. You know the summer has arrived when you look up and see large voluminous clouds. Blaise Bryan asked retired meteorologist Hugh Johnson about clouds and the summer forecast.
Hey, Hugh, hope you had a good week.
I did. Did you?
I did, yes. Just started a new job. It's going to be a little bit of a learning curve, but that's the case with any new job. So happy about that for sure.
Well, that's good. I'll add to your dendrites in your brain. It'll give you more, you know, brain power.
Yes. Well, on a rainy-ish Monday like today, I need all the brain power additions I can get. So where do we start here? Do we want to start with clouds? Do we want to start with a general summer forecast? I'll let you kind of take the lead on this here.
Let's talk about the clouds. We certainly had them this morning. We had them 3 days in a row earlier in the week, and but they didn't produce much rain. However, this morning, they produced half an inch of rain at my house. So the clouds are very, they can do very different things. They can be indicators. People can observe clouds, but they sometimes tell you a little something what's going to happen in the weather in the short term.
Yeah, and you said before we started recording here, you got a half an inch of rain in 25 minutes.
That's right. I mean, basically, we had when you get rain like that from clouds, what's happening is the clouds have depth. They're not just at a small layer. They go up a mile or a couple miles into the atmosphere, and there's a lot of drops to get that smash together. And there's a thing called crystallization, where when you get the drops lifting in the cold enough temperature, when you have the crystals, you actually pull a lot more moisture away from the smaller droplets, and then these bigger droplets can fall much quicker and give us a rain. Of course, it actually starts a lot of times, even in the summer, the precipitation involves some sub-freezing temperature, which helps to accelerate the size of the drop, and then it comes on down. Of course, it's 70 degrees. It was 70 degrees this morning, and you had the rain. So it's all rain, of course. It melts a long time, 10,000 feet off the ground.
Yeah, and what I found absolutely fascinating is the fact that a cloud weighs over 1 million pounds.
That's correct. It's as much as a big jet. It's quite heavy because there's a lot of cloud out there. The clouds can spread out for miles, and they have millions of little droplets in them. So as light as a cloud is definitely is kind of bogus.
You know, that's the first thing that went through my head when I read that in your prep email. So let's talk about the different types of clouds.
Okay. So we have five different, I mean, there are different ways to classify, but basically you have a stratus cloud, which is spread out. And stratus cloud is one, it's an interesting cloud because it doesn't always involve lift. It basically, if you get a moist air in contact with another slightly different temperature of air mass, you can actually result in you can contract the water vapor droplets out of the cloud and without much lift. So, and I saw this when I was at Thatcher Park on Friday, looking over the valley. I got a beautiful shot of stratus clouds just spreading out. Mm. And they're not that thick. They're really usually not that thick. And even though it might look ominous when you have them, that's what we had a couple days last week. Very little rain comes out of them because there's just not enough droplets to actually get large enough to come out of the clouds. So you have the stratus, you have the cumulus clouds, which are, those are the ones that have depth and ones that can rise way up into the atmosphere, even past the troposphere, tropopause. And those, of course, produce very heavy rain. And of course, you can the severe weather, lightning, all that good stuff. And then you have the rain, the nimbus clouds, which is a stratiform combination of stratiform, but you have lift. So they're thick enough to produce rain. And then you have the cirrus clouds, which are the hair clouds. They look kind of hairy, or they have that wispy look, and they're high clouds, and they almost never produce precipitation because they're too high up, but they're over 20,000 feet off the ground, and they're almost always cirrus clouds. I mean, always have crystals, ice crystals in them.
Mm.
But they can feed into lower clouds and produce what's called feeder, and that can help produce precipitation process because you get those ice crystals that we talked about, that once they hit contact with the other droplets, they pull a lot of moisture away, and then they actually increase the droplet size enough that it can come out of the cloud as precipitation.
Wow.
So let's see, am I missing it? Yeah, so, and I'm trying to think if there's another. There's one cloud that actually forms from sinking motion, the only cloud that does, the mematis, and these are the ones you see sometimes around thunderstorms that look like little bubbles coming out of the sky, kind of look eerie almost, and they can be associated with violent or severe weather, not always, but they're actually sinking. It's actually clouds with sinking motion, which is the only cloud, again, and they, what that was definitely, like, if you're a pilot, you don't want to get near those because they could be some pretty wicked turbulence. And that's another thing with clouds, you can look at the signature of clouds, and you can see if you see wavy clouds, because a lot of people talked about that, if you see the wavy cloud, chances are there's some turbulence going on, because it's like the cloud is like, think of it as a wave in the sky. It's up, there's rising and sinking motion going on next to each other. And that will probably mean turbulence. It's like waves in the sky. So when you see that kind of waviness in the clouds is probably a turbulent atmosphere. Cumulus clouds means it's an unstable atmosphere. Cirrus is stable. Now, I mean, not Cirrus, sorry, Stratus. Stratus means that we have a stable sky. However, you got to keep one thing in mind. You can have the cumulonimbus on top of the stratus, and then you actually had to end up in a situation where you might think it's stable, but it's not. So there, you know, sometimes you're fooled by that stratus layer. It obscures the stuff on top of it.
So you're able to eyeball what the different clouds are.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I'm a meteorologist. I did this for over 30 years. I better be able to. Yeah.
But is it something that the, I don't want to say untrained person, but someone who does not have a meteorology background, can they, do you think?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Just all you need to do is observe. You know, you look at, you know, you can look at charts and you can see what the basic cloud types are. And again, stratus are spread out. They're usually low. They're gray. They're very nondescript. Where cumulus clouds can go really, you know, they look like mountains in the sky. And the cirrus had the wispy look. And the, I forgot one, Alto, middle clouds, the ones that are like found 10 to 20,000 feet. There's a description for them too. But again, the main thing to look for, if you see like three dimensions in the clouds, then you're probably looking at instability. If you see waves in the clouds, you're looking at turbulence. And if you see them spread out, then at least at that layer, it's stable. Seeing it in first things. But, you know, trying to make a forecast if it's going to rain or not can get a little tricky because you can't always get all the pieces. That's where you need a radar to help you out on that one.
Sure. And we can talk about clouds more when we're back in a couple of weeks and you're actually joining us live. Yay. Looking forward to that.
Yay.
Yes.
Yeah.
What are we looking at for a general summer forecast? And then we'll transition into the week ahead.
Okay. Well, I think what I'm seeing is, I mean, so far this summer, the worst of the heat has stayed away from us. Yeah, it was hot this weekend. It got into the 90s, but there's been a big ridge and it's been staying a little bit to our west. And if anything, it's going to go further west. And I think what's going to happen is a trough's going to dig down over us and it may get wetter as we get into early July. Not this week. This week's going to be terrific after today. I think the rest of the week looks pretty good. I might do a really, really long bike ride later this week, but next week, I'm looking for this possible troughiness to develop and maybe get a little more wetter and more humid. And because there'll be a ridge to our east and a ridge to our west. And that's when that happens. A lot of times we get sandwiched in with this trough. We get a lot of rain sometimes. We got that last summer. That's what happened last summer in July. People might not remember, but we had a pretty dry June and then we went into a very wet July. Hopefully not that wet, but I see that as a trend. And then maybe August, we go back to hotter and drier again. We'll see, but we have to watch the tropics because they're going to come alive in the next few weeks and it could be very active. So I think we're going to end up with another wet summer overall, even though it's been dry and temperatures a little bit above normal. We'll probably get one or two heat waves, but I'm not looking for any super heat most of the summer. I don't think we'll hit 100. We haven't hit 100 since 1953, so that's a pretty good bet.
Yes. Well, there you go. And the week ahead, aside from today, looks good?
Looks good. Big high pressure built in. And then another little one comes down from Canada on Wednesday, Thursday. So it keeps the heat at bay. We'll be, you know, in the 80s, very comfortable. And then it looks like it gets hot at the end of the week, going into the weekend. And unfortunately, the weekend might get a little unsettled. That troughiness might be beginning to form. So I 4th of July could get a little unsettled, but doesn't look like a complete washout at this point, but you know, we'll have to keep an eye out for the possibility of thunderstorms as we get into the weekend. But until then, after today, it looks good. Looks like very little chance of rain, lots of sunshine, warm temperatures, not too humid.
All right. Well, Hugh, you have a great week and a great 4th because it's Monday. We're off. Yep. We'll catch up with you in a couple of weeks.
Got it. Have a good one there, Blaze.
You too.
That was our weekly weather segment with Hugh Johnson and Blaze Bryant. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. And until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.